copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Let's talk about engagements. If we wanted to have fun, we could probably, and we had the time, it would be fun to go around and hear some of the stories of how those of you who are married, how either the guy popped the question or whatever that they wanted to marry him, and I've seen all kinds. I've seen the kind where they happen at airport or maybe you've seen it on the jumbotrons at a sports event. Somebody wants to ask somebody to marry them. Flash mobs do it. Most of them you see there's maybe you're in a nice restaurant and you see a couple over in a corner, and you see the guy drop down to his knee, and it's very privately done. And I didn't have a lot of class when I decided to ask Darcy to marry me. I was just such a doofus and didn't know what I was doing that I simply had bought her a ring, and we were watching one of the big college football games, American football games, on New Year's Day, and during halftime, I pulled out the ring and said, "Hey, you want to get married?" And she said, "Yeah, sure." And I forgot you're supposed to get down on one knee, so I didn't do that. But apparently it worked. And she got up and showed her mother. And, you know, there's all kinds of settings to ask somebody to marry you. But the one place I think would be a lousy place to ask somebody to marry you is at a public execution. But that's exactly where God asked us to marry him. That's exactly where Jesus went to pop the question to you and me, that he wanted to marry us. But he had to first pay the dowry price, which was his life for our sin. He didn't have precious gold and diamonds to hand us. They had cruel spikes to pound into his hands. He didn't get down on one knee. They pushed him up on a cross and nailed him there. He didn't have friends waiting to celebrate after. He had a bunch of drunks and evil people mocking him. And the friends he did have, they were nowhere to be found. And yet that's what he did for us. That's how much he loved us. And it was his love and grace that brought him to the cross. And he said, "Now I want to transfer my heart into yours. And I want to do a complete work in you and set you free from all the guilt, the shame, the issues, the junk, all the history and the regrets, so that you can truly be free in your life and in the lives of the people closest to you. And in our role as husbands and wives and as parents and grandparents." Well, when God's grace overwhelms our heart attitude to our spouse, it helps us see things. For instance, we see our spouse's truest needs. Now, this is going to sound familiar because I'm going to walk my way right up that house. We see our spouse's truest needs, and like their need for a secure love. God's grace helps us accept them and maintain a strong affiliation with the passions of their heart. We become friends and not competitors. We become teammates rather than just roommates. Romans chapter 12, verses 15 and 16. This is from the New Living Bible translation. "Be happy with those who are happy, and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people, and don't think you know it all." I love that line. Live in harmony with each other. Okay, that's Romans chapter 12, verses 15 and 16. How many of you have a pretty good musical foundation to you? You know, you either can play an instrument or you can sing pretty well, okay? Come on, we have some musicians here. Okay, well, in music, harmony is very important. It's fun when a person can naturally sing harmony. I can sing harmony pretty easily. Somebody sings a melody, I can figure out just what you do. And harmony complements a melody. That when you hear it, it enriches the melody. And so when we worship God, obviously the instruments are playing chords that are all harmonically arranged that they go together. But see, discord If somebody got up there and one of us that didn't know how to play the guitar or the piano said, okay, well, we'll do it. I'll do the best we can. We're just up there pounding away. Even if we're getting the rhythm right, it would sound awful because it would be discordant. Because there are notes that don't go together. They don't complement. And he says he wants us to live in a harmonious way. And so when we're desiring to give a secure love to each other, we live in harmony. Now, another way when it comes to giving a secure love to our spouse, another way would be our spouse feels secure when we show them consistent affection. God set aside marriage as a safe haven for enjoying guilt-free, generous, and enjoyable sexual intimacy with our spouse. Let me say that again. He set aside marriage as a safe haven for enjoying guilt-free, generous, and enjoyable sexual intimacy. In fact, if you really wanted to play with the people that you're ministering to sometime, like at a marriage retreat, I did this at a marriage conference, and I was actually speaking with another guy, and he thought I'd lost my mind, but I said, there's only one reason why any of you married the other person, and that's to have sex with them. And this guy, you've lost your mind. But let's back up. When you think of the standard reasons why people say they got married, they say, well, we love each other. Well, I love my parents. I love my siblings. I don't want to marry them. Love doesn't require a marriage certificate. Well, we just like to be together. Well, that's called friendship. I have all kinds of friends. I enjoy being with them. Don't require a marriage certificate. Well, we wanted to bring our assets and our money together. Those are called companies, so corporations. They don't require, they might require some contractual paperwork, but not a marriage certificate. That's not one of them. And, we like to travel. Those are called tours. You can go on a ship, whatever, but it doesn't require a marriage certificate. See, all the things that we say we got married for don't require a marriage certificate. They're some of the things that we enjoy once we are married, but they don't. There's only one. And God said, you know, that this is where sexual intimacy, I built this need into you, and I want you to enjoy it inside a marriage. And then once you're in there, then, of course, all these other things are add-ons to it. But sex is one of the things that I think has really been a major part of disappointment in so many people's marriages, even in Christian marriages. It's been abused and confused part of our human relationships. Think about it. Culture trivializes it. Hollywood panders to it. Pornographers capitalize on it. Some Christian circles marginalize it, or they put a lot of guilt and so forth around it. And too many people worship it and make it the center focus of everything about their life. And God, see, all those things take a couple way off their game, and you can't enjoy a secure love inside of that. You know, the cool thing about marriage, I mean, sex and marriage, is God, among other things, God gives us a little taste of what Eden was like before sin entered the world. Think about this. What did he say about Adam and Eve? They were both naked and unashamed. And he wants to give us, at least with one person, what that was like to be actually in that situation, completely transparent with someone and not be ashamed. And so he gives us a little taste of that in marriage. It's a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, our culture views sex as an appetizer to marriage and then a weapon you use against each other after you're married. And once again, this is not necessarily something that Christian people don't struggle with too. God meant sex to be a high priority in our marriage. And I'm not talking about frequency or the focus you may or may not have on it. It's just saying that this is something that was meant to be highly regarded, highly respected, highly protected in this relationship. And yet, when you look at so many married couples, what are some of the standard problems they have? I'm going to list off, and we go into more depth in the book, Grace-Filled Marriage, on this. But here's some of the things that I've noticed that many couples do when it comes to sex. They use it to manipulate the other person. They use it to get something that they want and to control that other person. And then some people use it to punish the other person. You're not deserving of this. If you would just act even remotely close to what you should, maybe, but otherwise, no. And then I see another way is they see it as an obligation. An obligation. Well, it's Sunday night, time for our weekly interlude here. Let's go, okay, ready, go. Let's get this over with. And when you're on the receiving end of that attitude, you might feel like we just had sex, but you don't feel like we made any love. We exchanged any type of joy at the heart level. And then I see two extreme ends on the intimacy scale that often come into marriage and even in Christian marriages. One is where somebody demands it. They demand it. And listen, there is nothing in the Bible that would justify that. Think about this. Does God demand us anything from us? When you think of any of the things that we're supposed to do as followers of Jesus, how many does he demand? You better do this or else. I mean, none. Could he do that? And the answer is absolutely. He's God of the universe. He could do whatever he wanted to. He could get in our grill and he could make us do stuff. But he doesn't, because he's dealing with us according to his heart of love and grace. So demanding is, anybody that does that does not have the heart of Christ and is not representing the work of the cross, no matter what they've put their faith in. The other one is defrauding. That's the other extreme, defrauding, denying it. Now, there's probably a couple of reasons why this might happen. And one might just be indifference towards the spouse. I don't care what you need. I'm not going to provide it. I don't care what marriage is about. I'm not going to give it to you. I don't want to. I don't like you. Whatever. And then sometimes this is caused by issues that we either brought into the marriage or received inside the marriage. We over the years, we've counseled a lot. And I'm sure you guys could give us war stories of people you work with where there's guilt or there's shame that's in their life that is holding them hostage, and they just don't feel free to go into this area with their spouse because of something that happened. And sometimes it's something that happened with them and somebody else. The spouse had nothing to do with it. They're just the one that's punished by it. It might be a crime that was done against their heart, because sometimes sexual crimes are done against people, and those can really cut so deep. Or maybe they were promiscuous in their younger years and Satan is wanting to lock them down and hold them hostage. The problem with this, though, is what is the spouse supposed to do? Because there's no other godly, God-ordained outlet for them to meet this need in their life other than each other in a marriage. That's why we get married. That's why God wanted us to have each other for this. And each couple's need for one another may be different, but that's what we're there for. And yet, many couples have enormous stress in this, and then they use the Bible to justify why they're holding back or whatever. And this doesn't represent the heart of God. See, God is always there to meet our needs. Always there. And so when we defraud, it gets the best of us. And let me say something about shame, because shame is an awful, awful thing. And it's a real, oh man, what a lockdown type of emotion it is. But shame many times is a hiding place. And I'm going to say things that are difficult here, but shame is many times a hiding place for our pride, where we don't want to give this over to God and let him cleanse us and set us free of it. We just don't want to. Anna and I were talking about a friend of hers that during the break, that may well be that there's some holdout areas that she just doesn't want to surrender that to God because she wants to control. And many times that's the way we cope, is we control. And many times it's this stuff right here. It's these kind of lenses that we're looking through, and we want to manage it. But this really takes us down. And I've even seen people that make a, think if this makes any sense, they make a shrine to their misery or their regrets. They actually set it up on a pedestal and they worship it and they live in it. I don't know what kind of therapeutic training you've had, but there's some therapeutic models that really want people to revisit their pain over and over again. And I just don't like those. I don't see how those things play out in a God that went to the cross to set us free and put this behind us. And there's some that not only you revisit, you remember, you reenact, you play out the emotions, and you go back over and over again, sometimes for years at a time. I think, seriously, why would you want to do that? And yet they call this therapy. And then, you know, there's good therapy, there's bad therapy, there's all that, good counseling, bad counseling. But that's the kind of stuff that I think really insults the cross. It insults it. It says, I don't care what you did on the cross for me, Jesus, I'm just not going to receive it. And while I'm at it, I'm going to punish my spouse in this area of intimacy. And so, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, it says, therefore, if anyone's in Christ, he's a new creation. Old things are gone. The new has come. All these, this is from God who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. So where he wants us to start that ministry of reconciliation is on ourselves. It's what you were talking about there, where the forgiveness starts with being forgiven and accepting that. Because these things can really hold a marriage hostage. So Darcy and I, we got married and seminary and all that stuff, and we're like any other couple, you know, we're excited about it because we did not live together before, we were not sexually active before we got married, and so we got married, and like everybody else, you realize, wow, you know, you come at this thing from different angles, and one's in the mood when the other's not in the mood, and getting, you know, and all, it's always a bit of a awkward dance. And not sure, and then you know, and then if you have issues going on, and you've been looking at each other through these different lenses, you're not so inclined, or you're frustrated, or you don't feel they deserve it, and all that normal human stuff, and so we're trying to think, well, what would a grace attitude look like when it comes to this, because this is the main feature of our lives as couples. How many couples do we have here? Married couples. Here, where a husband and wife are here. Okay, back there, right there. We have three? Okay, but all of you folks are married. I could say the one thing that you have unique with your spouse that you share with nobody else is this. This is that private world that is only for you two. And so we thought, okay, this is our world, and this is the unique thing of our marriage. And all, how do we do this? So we had to come up with some way of saying, what would be an attitude that would reflect the gracious heart of God? Now, don't laugh your head off or don't think that we've lost our mind. Just work with me here for a second. Do you all know what a convenience store is? Do you have that term where you live? You know, they're like, they're not in the corner. They're not a big grocery store. They're just a small thing, but they're open all the time, 24 hours a day, and they're always available, and they're always there when you need them. We call them convenience stores. And so we said, okay, let's practice convenience store sex with each other. That's what we called it, convenience store sex, meaning we're always available to each other. May not be our idea, may not be inclined at the moment just because of other things, or you know, at least not be focused on that or thinking about that, but we're available to one another because she may be in a mood when I'm not, or I might be in a mood when she's not, but how do you get there? I mean, unless you plan some big weekend, you know, it's rarely comes on time. And so we adopted this attitude. Let's just have this attitude that we're always available to one another, and we have a desire to meet each other's needs, that we just have that. That's our default attitude, so that even if it wasn't our idea, we can get into it with that person and really enjoy them. And that really helped us because you know you don't want to go around sexually hungry because you're walking around in a world that's filled with all kinds of sexual junk food. It's all around you, and so God gave us marriage and sex and marriage, so we won't go around sexually hungry. But if we're looking at it through these lenses and we're not letting a God's gracious attitude come through us, if we're not treating each other the way God treats us, if we're not there to meet each other's needs whenever that person has that need, well then we could find ourselves really succumbing or having to battle these problems out there on a level. Now, by the way, having this attitude does not give anybody the right to be a sexual addict. Sexual addiction is not gracious. Sexually demanding, that's not gracious. And obviously, if we're gracious people, we take into consideration fatigue other things that are preoccupying a person, or the kids are demanding, and we took all that into consideration. But we just said, let's just be there for each other. Look at what the Word of God says in this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 5. Do not deprive each other of sexual relations unless you both agree to refrain from sexual intimacy for a limited time so you can give yourself more completely to prayer or whatever. Afterward, you should come together again so that Satan won't be able to tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Because I'm a speaker, I travel around. God doesn't trust me with a church much longer than a weekend, and then I have to move on. So I'm more of most pastors are pastors to a church, and then there's a handful that are pastors to the church. And so I'm more go around and speak. And so normally when I go to speak, I'm usually the only speaker. But it's kind of fun when you come to something like this where there's a lot of speakers, and you not only get to speak, but you get to hear a lot and be ministered to. Well, I went to an event in the U.S., and this was quite a while ago, and I was just one of the speakers, but not one of the main speakers. I was a young man, and these guys were really big-shot dudes, and they were very famous and so forth. So I went there, and two of the guys that were I'd heard about before, and I was really glad to speak. I got to meet them, and they said, "Well, we're going to dinner. Come to dinner with us." Oh, cool. So I went out to dinner with them, and they're visiting, and they knew each other very well. And I'm more just listening, and they started talking, and they're talking about all kinds of things and travels. And then one talked about his family and his boy. I'm really struggling with my wife right now. We're really having a tough time. And then the other is he was transparent. Well, we are too. It's just been really difficult. And as they were describing what was going on, it sounded like they were looking at each other through these lenses a lot. Well, then one got on to talking about, their intimate life is basically non-existent. They just had no sexual relations for some time just because there's just so much of a wall built between them. And then the other guy admitted the same thing. He said, "Oh, yeah," and I'm just listening. Then we got dessert, and they had changed subject. And then it came. Then one guy, he was talking about, he was out at a place, and he was speaking. Back at a hotel, and a woman came on real strong to him. And it was everything he could do to resist temptation. Then another guy told about an episode he had in an elevator with a lady. And then this guy came back and he told about one, and like at an airport. And this guy's going, and they're going back, and they're just going one story after another about women coming on to them and how hard it's been for them. And I'm listening. So finally, flying home, thinking about this, and I told Darcy about this. I didn't tell her about who the guys were, just the exchange of the difficulty that they were talking about. And I said, "Darcy, I must have loser written all over me. Because in all my travels, I've never once had a woman come on to me. Not once." And it must be the biggest dork out there. And she says, "Oh, that has nothing to do with it. You have a red light glowing inside of you. Those guys have a green light glowing, or at least a yellow light glowing. They're hungry. And women can tell." See, God gave us marriage to satisfy one another so we don't have to be that way. But I think it's very difficult to have a kind of a generous attitude towards one another if we haven't received the generous love and mercy and grace of God, and it's center stage in our life, and it's part of our DNA and our makeup in our relationship with Him. Another reference you could put down there is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, and it just talks about how in marriage, we have mutual ownership of one another's body that you give each other as a gift. Well, when intimacy is a healthy part of a marriage, it allows a couple to bring a better focus on their other priorities. And that's another thing about those guys is how this was undermining so much of their ministry and their ability to do what God called them to do just because this one area of their life was in such dire straits. Let's look at the second level there, in that we know grace gives us the ability to know their deepest longings. You know, like giving them the freedom to be different. Remember we said that's one of the freedoms we give? I'll tell you this story. I hope this is funny to you because it was hilarious to me. A couple got married in the winter time. They had not been sexually active with each other, so this is their first time in their honeymoon night. And it was winter. It was like December, and it was very cold. And they ended up, like most couples do in their honeymoon night, without anything on, except she had kept on a pair of, you know what tube socks are? They're kind of, you know, comfortable socks you keep on your feet. And so she kept those on. That's all she had on. And then the next time she had those on, the next time, and she got to wear, she kind of liked those socks on when they were being intimate. And she got to wear, she kind of connected to that, much like a child connects to a blanket or a doll, you know, a teddy bear or something. So she would, and of course the guy didn't care. This is great. But year after year, she kept those same tube socks. And of course they get pretty old and tattered and the elastic was gone and they're sagging down, and if she thought they were going to be intimate, she'd just run in and put them on. Or if they were going on a trip, she'd take them with her. Or they were going somewhere, if she thought, well, one thing will lead to another, she always had them with her in her purse or something. So this guy got to where this started to really annoy him. And it just bothered him that it was like that credit card thing. He was looking at that all the time, and no matter, you know, she'd be very fun and exciting, but she, it would just turn him off because he'd take the tubes. Oh, I just like them. Don't worry about it. You're going to have a fun time. You know, just leave my, you know, don't worry about my socks. And so, and then he'd go get her something fun to wear, and she'd go and put it on, have the tube socks on, and it would just turn them off. And so it was just crazy. And finally, they went to the counselor. And the counselor said, "So why are you here?" And the guy, came out of this like a horse coming out of a racehorse coming out of the blocks. And he started on the tube socks drama. And from the beginning and on up to these years, a decade later, in the same stupid tube socks and going on. And she's sitting there listening, and the counselor's listening. And finally, when this guy got this all off his chest, he turned to the lady and said, "Did you bring those things with you?" She said, "Yeah, I figured this would be the subject was about." So, and she put him down there on a little table there. The guy looked at him. Counselor, and he looked back at this guy and said, "Are you out of your mind? I know guys that would kill for a set of socks like that for their wife. If they could get those socks to do for their wife what they do for your wife, if we could figure out how to package this stuff and manufacture, we'd be billionaires. And we could sell these things all over the world. People would love them. Get over it, man." You know, but what he was doing, he was focusing on one thing and not letting his wife the freedom to just be different. So she had a little quirky weirdness about her sock. Get over it. So once he finally got there, and it was really an issue of trying to treat her the way God treats us, you know, then he started seeing them differently, and the socks started showing up in her life. You know, she'd get in her car and they were draped over the mirror, you know, the rearview mirror. Or she'd go to the microwave and they're sitting in there, you know. And so he realized these are actually a good thing. We got to give our spouse the freedom to be different and the freedom to be vulnerable. We have four children, and our youngest is a boy named Colt. And we took our three older ones off to university and dropped them off and all this stuff like you normally do in the years before. But when we took Colt up to Northern Arizona University, this was a little different. Because when we got them all moved in and had dinner with them and finally said goodbye to them and kissed them goodbye out there in the parking lot, and we started our two-hour drive back to Phoenix, it was very quiet in the car. And I could hear Darcy sniffling. And then crying. And this is different than when we said goodbye to the other ones. It wasn't because, and I thought, well, you know, maybe she's missing them. And then when she started saying, she said, "I just got pink slipped." Do you know what pink slipped means? It's an American term. That they used to, when you got fired from a job, they put it on a pink slip and said, "You're fired." "I just got fired from my job. I've been a mother. And now I'm not going to be a mother anymore." She knew she was going to be always their mother, but the role she'd been playing on an ongoing basis that she did so well and she enjoyed so much. And I could have said, "Oh, for crying out loud, he'll be down in 2 weeks with a whole basket full of dirty clothes." And, you know, I could have said, but that wasn't what she needed. She needed the freedom to be vulnerable and to work that through. because it was hard for her to adjust. Yeah, being an empty nest couple and all the things that come with it, that's fun too, but this was a transition she had to work through. Grace helps them through those kind of things. And then freedom to be candid, and the freedom to process mistakes. I tell a story in the book about a couple. They got married, and what they didn't realize when they got married is she had some ghosts from her teenage years that when it comes to sex, that were going to haunt her in her marriage. And so she, on her honeymoon, everything was great, and he thought this is going to be a great marriage, but he didn't realize this is going to be short-lived, because things started shutting down shortly after they got back from their honeymoon and all, and then her availability to him and her all that stuff just really changed, and he couldn't understand why. And then, of course, he'd bring it up, and she thought he was being insensitive or demanding or whatever, and it just really got bad, and this went on for years. And somehow they managed to have conceive a couple of kids, but their life, their personal private life was really under great stress. And he never knew that it was because of some decisions she had made and promiscuity as a teenager. Then she became a Christian, and she decided, you know, she was going to stay pure up to that. And they were not sexually active, but she never told him about that. Nor did she let Christ set her free from that. She carried that in, and it was haunting her. Well, because of the frustration he was having, next thing you know, he went on the internet, and he got hooked into porn. And she wasn't responsible for that, you know, no one's blaming her in the sense, but there was a minefield that was put around him. Anyway, so he went into that. When she found that out, she just went after him. I mean, she so humiliated him, and then she wanted to destroy him. So she told her parents, and she told the pastor and all the people in her small group, so that, he, you know, you're always going to be having a hard time showing your face back at the church, and really mocked and humiliated him. Finally, they went to the counselor. And once they got to the counselor, and all the counselor, in very short order, opened the door on her past. And that's when she revealed this is what's been haunting her. Well, now it's this guy decide whether he's going to react or respond. And he reacted. You mean to tell me all this time, all this suffering I've had to go through is because of something somebody else did to you and you did with them that I had nothing to do with? I'm the one that cast my lot with you. I'm the one that believed in you. Why would you do this to me? See, neither one of them were showing grace. And all she wanted to do was humiliate him and destroy him because of the pornography. Now, let me ask you. If a man or a woman is really hooked up in pornography and they finally come to God in repentance, does he destroy them? He said, okay, still, you had no right. I'm going to take you out. No, they find mercy. They find mercy. And when somebody finds out that there's something from the past that really has been, Satan has been holding them hostage over, and they want their way out, you should be wanting to help them. And see, neither one of them had grace to bring to bear. And the counselor had to work hard with them to help them see. You're dealing with each other the complete opposite of the way God has already dealt with you. Why don't we let his work on the cross be a finished work? And so God wants us to do that in their deepest longings. Then, now, number three, Corey, you're good at this. Watch this. We understand our greatest challenges. Corey talked as he was walking through about core muscles and character yesterday. And you know, when you go to work out, they want you to isolate some of the main muscles in your body. So if you get those strong, then the other ones can stay healthier. And there are six core muscles of character. And the way we got these is I took an, you know what an exhaustive concordance is? They're all online now, but they have these old ones like Young's analytical concordance stuff, and it has every verse in the Bible and every word in the Bible that's used. So I went and I started at the beginning, and I got a piece of paper and I wrote down every character word in the Bible. Just wrote it every time there's a thing that talks about the kind of right behavior. I wrote it down. Quality of characters. I went all the way through. It took me hours to go through this whole thing, almost a whole day. And I filled up this thing. I wrote small, so I filled up this big, but it's just crowded with words. And then, as I looked at it, I thought, well, you know, nobody can remember all these, but some of these are synonyms. They're in the same family. And so I took another piece of paper out, and I started kind of listing them and clumping them in families, and they fell into six clumps. And then from there, I said, okay, what's the word you can take out and put at the top that the other ones are good sub-points of? And that's how we got five of the six words. There's one word I borrowed from the English dictionary. So the six character traits are faith, and they're on your napkin card. Faith, integrity, poise. That's the one I borrowed from the English dictionary. Remember, it means a clean, keen sense of the appropriate balance. Poise, disciplines, endurance, and courage. I saw a great example of this in something I participated in. And when I was turning 50, I went through a dark chapter of my life where I felt like I wanted to run a marathon. And it was a stupid thing that I got into for a while. I don't know why anybody would want to run 26 miles, 385 yards, or whatever that is in kilometers. How far is it in kilometers? 42 something kilometers. But I decided I'm going to run a marathon. So I trained for the marathon. I thought, well, if I'm going to run a marathon, I want to go to one that's going to be kind of fun, you know, and it stays in a great place. How about the New York City Marathon? So I signed up for it. Sure enough, I got into it. And so I trained for the New York City Marathon. And so I went there, and Darcy was there, and the New York City Marathon, New York is made up of five boroughs, and the marathon starts down in one of the boroughs, Staten Island, and you end up running through Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx and into Manhattan. And so you cover them all over the 26 miles or 42 kilometers. And so, but there's a real old fort that goes back to the time of our revolution called Fort Wadsworth, right down at the mouth of the river that comes into New York. And that's where the staging area was for all the runners. There were like 30,000 of us down there, and they have rock and roll going and big banners, and it's all very festive and fun. You get down there in position, and about 11 o'clock, they're going to fire the cannons and the takeoff, and they let the Kenyans go first. And they because they're going to win it. And when I wasn't even halfway done with the marathon, they were already sipping champagne in Central Park. But anyway, so they take off. And but as we were all stretching out and getting ready, there was this brick wall, and over there was a couple, and she had decorated her running shoes with like some lace, and she had on a little t-shirt that came down long, was kind of white, and she put some stuff on that, and she had a veil, a little thing in her hair, a flower, and she had a bouquet, and then he had on one of those t-shirts that looks like a tuxedo, and they brought a preacher there, and they got married right there just before the marathon. And so I thought, well, that's kind of cool, getting married just before the marathon. And I said, you have no idea how accurate this is, because you just signed up for a marathon. Because marriage is a marathon, and it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. But the difference is you don't have thousands of people cheering you along the way like we did in New York City. There's a lot of lonely kilometers out there and rough road. But anyway, they got married. It turns out they were basically in the same speed bracket that I was in, and which I should have said slow bracket that I was in. And so we all took off in the same group. There was about 1,000 of us took off together, go off across the bridge into Brooklyn. But they were younger, and they took off, and they got out ahead of me. But I came in, I was a couple miles into Brooklyn, and I saw them on the side, and he was over there kind of throwing up, and she's patting him on the back. Apparently he celebrated a little too much at his wedding and drank too much. And so he's throwing up, and she's patting him on the back. And I thought, oh, man, that get used to that. You're going to do a lot of that over the duration of your marriage. And then we run along, and then they pass me. And I didn't see them till towards the end of the race. The race comes down to the Bronx and into Central Park. Now, Central Park's a very big park. It's several miles. And so once you get there, you still have 3 or 4 miles left. And I got into Central Park, and I was coming down about a mile, mile and a half left, and I saw them on the side. And this time, she was on the ground, and she was crying, and he had her shoe off, and she had bad blisters on her feet. And so the race was over for her. It was done. You can't run with blisters like that. And he was trying to comfort her and look at her. So anyway, I went on around, and I finished, and I came across the finish line, and then they wrap you up in a space blanket, and then they give you this lunch. And I needed sugar, so there was an apple there. So I just thought, I'm going to sit down here and eat this apple, get some energy back into me. And I'm watching the runners are all coming in. And I was sitting there, and I looked off in the distance, and there they were. They were coming, but they weren't side by side anymore because of her feet. He had picked her up. And he's just working like mad to get her down there and get her across the field. And you know, after 26 miles or 41 kilometers, I mean, you know, he's all out. But he worked it, and he came across the finish line, and they put the medals over their heads and wrapped them up in blankets. And then they went over, and they just collapsed onto the grass over to the side. And I kind of stiffly walked back to see them, and they were just like they were asleep together with each other. And I thought, well, that is such an example of what this marriage is that they work so hard to build each other's character, the physical muscles up for that race. And as when we build it up, we carry sometimes each other through with the faith, integrity, the poise, the disciplines, endurance, and courage that we have in our own life. And then let's look at the last scenario. We envision their highest potential. When I think of when I think of the goals that so many couples bring to marriage, some of them come in and they have success goals. They want to make, you know, the wealth, beauty, power, fame stuff. Others have noble goals, like they want to better serve their family, or they want to do things for the poor and the helpless, or they want to make the world a better place. Some people come in with holy goals. How do they please God more? And how can I do things that add to my eternal reward? These are all things that I go into depth in these in the book, the ways we go into that we bring these things. But all those things may sound good, but I think they fall short of what our ultimate focus should be in our marriage. That when we get up, these what we go after shouldn't be our primary things. Darcy and I were this young and raising our kids, and you know, we're up there our eyeballs and dirty diapers and earaches and, you know, broken night's sleep and fatigue. And so I wanted to do something nice for her. And so I thought, I'll take her out to a jazz club. And in our town at that time, there weren't a whole lot. There are now, but there weren't a whole lot. And at that time, there was only one. And there was a guy singing there that was an old crooner that had been on Broadway and on television and stuff like that. But he was really old. And so I was surprising Darcy with this. And I finally got her in the car. We had a babysitter and taken her out to this jazz club. And I told her who we were going to go here, and she says, too bad our parents aren't here. They could watch, you know, because I didn't know she didn't really like this guy that much. Now, it was also near her birthday, so I'd gone by earlier, and I'd bought a new wristwatch for her, and I had it wrapped up, and I gave it to the maitre d' and said, hey, we're coming here tonight, and when it comes time for dessert, will you bring this out, you know, have somebody bring it out on a little plate and give it to my wife. And then there was a card with it, so I'd written a little something on the card and put that with it, you know, put her name on it and so forth. Well, so the guy's singing away, and we ordered dessert, and sure enough, here comes her birthday gift and the card on it, and Darcy opened up the card to read while this guy's singing away, and she read it, and I could tell, you know, she just kind of looked at that. They had one of those looks on her face like something was, and then she put it away, starts to open the thing, and wait a minute, did I say something wrong? Of course, I couldn't remember what I said because I'm so attention deficit disorder. I had no idea what I'd written on that thing that afternoon. But, and she's, it's not important. No, it is important. What is it? And so finally she took it. She turned around. And I'd written, and by the way, I'd heard this somewhere. I thought this sounded really poetic. I said, you're my reason for living. Love, Tim. And she said, I can't be your reason for living. I can't be that. I'll let you down. I can guarantee you I'll let you down. I'm a human being, and I'm going to die someday. Then what? What if I die first? Then what? There's only one person that can be your reason for living. His name is Jesus. I'm thinking, great, she's going theological on me and in the middle of this thing. And then about this time, when we're starting this thing, this guy comes over. He heard about her birthday, and he's crooning to her, singing his song, real close, a love song to her. Oh, man, I wanted to crawl under the rug. So anyway, it was a rough moment in our life, but it was also a good moment because it was reminding me what's most important. Because when we make our spouse our reason for living, or our kids, or our ministry, or anything else, and it's anything but Jesus, we fall short. I want to read you a poem that I wrote for our daughter. In fact, the girl that did the social media, Karis, that's our oldest daughter. And She got married to a wonderful man named Mike, and she asked me if I would do a blessing for her in the wedding. And the guy that was my best man was performing the wedding for her, and I got to walk her down the aisle and sit down and watch her get married, which was very exciting. But she said, "Will you do a blessing?" And I thought, okay, what do I do? And I decided to write her a poem that I read to her at the wedding. But I think this poem kind of summarizes all we're trying to say here about a marriage where grace is in place and it goes the distance. Here's what I said, and then we're going to let you all give us some feedback. I said, "A good man stands beside you, and he longs to trust your heart. He's been loyal to his brother, a fine son from the start. He's everything you prayed for, and he puts my fears at rest. But somewhere past this moment, life will put you to a test. You see, it almost seems too easy in this shrine of vows and rings to think that you will always want to love and do good things. But I've learned life has imposters that can slip in through the seams of a love that gets distracted by the lure of earthly themes. And so please let these father words sink somewhere deep inside, and pray they hold you vigilant should life toy with your pride. For somewhere in the future, who knows just when or where, these fickle friends will call your bluff and test how much you care. Suppose you find the gifts you've honed and polished through the years become a source of marvel and looked up to by your peers. Regardless of the headlines or the stars beside your name, please keep your arms around this man and love him more than fame. And should your life be blessed with far more goods than you can count, like Midas with his golden touch, success's silver fount, you may be so inclined to put your heart in money's health. Don't do it, my sweet daughter. Love this man more than wealth. You might just find that through the years, your home becomes a place that turns each soul that visits you into a well-known face, a home filled with contagious joy that causes hearts to blend. In all that fun, don't fail to love this man far more than friends. And sometimes in the clutter and the hurry of the day, the worst might get the best of you and make you want to say that you're tired of all the pressures. You're weary of love's tests. Just keep your hands clenched tightly in his and love him more than rest. And what if, by divine design, you're called to some great cause, some noble goal or effort that can haunt with fear or pause? And should it all require a peek into the throat of death, just hold this man with all you've got and love him more than breath. Oh, please, dear daughter, love this man. Yet, do not think this odd. Be careful that no matter what, you love him less than God. For in the shadow of the cross, in spite of second place, he'll know, he'll see, his heart's secure by the peace on your sweet face. The greatest gift you give his wife is loving Christ above your life. And so I bid you now to bless. Go love him more and love him less." It is about the cross. Thank you. Thank you. It is just the sum total of the work of the cross. When we let him finish his work in us, and not only save us from our sin, but now completely set us free. And we bring that to our marriage. We bring that to our role as parents and grandparents. Everything changes.